Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, and that was the theme music to Ariel Luckey's performance art piece called Freeland. We talk in depth today with Ariel Luckey about his art and his grappling with the reality that he and his family, like most of the white population in the United States today, derives privilege from a very violent past. Before we turn to Ariel Luckey, we're privileged to have Dar Jamail with us again this week from doing his independent reports from the spill zone in the Gulf of Mexico, this time from Alabama.
Right now I'm looking out a window at nice, beautiful white sand beaches and rows of orange and yellow boom starting from about probably 20 meters off the beach out in the water, going out to probably at least 200 or 300 meters out. So it's quite an interesting situation. There's also cleanup buggies carting cleanup workers up and down the beach amidst people laying out sunbathing and trying to be on vacation, I guess.
So it's a resort and people are just doing business as usual.
They are, except, of course, it's against the backdrop of booms and cleanup operations and fears that more oil is on the way.
Are there any people actually venturing into the water?
There are, which has been kind of surprising. We've been driving the coast much of yesterday. We stopped off at Gulfport and did a trip out to the Ship Island, which is one of the barrier islands there that's actually part of the a national seashore. So it's basically part of a national park. And there were people out there swimming. Even some folks looking like they were going to fish, and there, where there's literally plenty of tarballs on the beach, we took photos of those and watched cleanup crews working. And again, so it's kind of a bit of a surreal experience to, here we are at the height of the summer tourist season, especially here in these beach areas where people want to go out and swim and sit on the beach and enjoy being on the Gulf. And yet you can't get away from, there's boom everywhere, there's cleanup crews all over the place, and in most of these places there are still tar balls either already on the beach or still washing up on them.
You know, Dar, I live on the beach in San Francisco Bay, and this morning I went out for an early morning walk, and we had a spill here last fall with a Dubai Sun. And we still have signs up on our beach now. Some of them are warning about tarballs, and some of them are warning about a skin irritation if you go into the water. And still people go in and swim, and I'm wondering if there are signs up there that people are just walking past.
Yeah, it's the same scene. There are those signs. In fact, we got in late last night, so we haven't really strolled around yet here to see them. I imagine they're here, but going out to Ship Island, as we did yesterday on the boat, you take an hour-long ferry ride out to this boat across the Mississippi Sound, and then there you're at Ship Island, which is a barrier island. And as you walk down the boardwalk to the island, there are signs and National Park lifeguards out there sitting by the signs that say, you know, there is oil, there's, you know, don't touch it, you can swim, but don't get any on you, use common sense, this kind of things. And I talked to the lifeguard there, and he said, look, yeah, we understand that this is dangerous and that there's not, you know, it's toxic, but basically he taking his instructions from the federal government, you know, clearly there is a goal to kind of maintain a sense of normalcy, try to encourage people to try to keep acting as though things are under control and this isn't such a big deal. And yet there are people swimming in this stuff. So I had a little talk with him about the toxicity of the dispersants and that this stuff's coming up and you can't always see it. And, you know, even while we were there, though, we could see parts of sheen around that island and plenty of photos of tar balls on the beach and tar-stricken driftwood that we'll be posting those in the earlier part of this coming week. But it's just amazing that, you know, there are people. You know, I can understand the sense of wanting to believe that things are okay and then things are going to get better, and yet things are continuing to get worse. The signs of it are all over the place, and yet there are still people going out into the water and swimming in this stuff.
And at the same time, the New York Times today, for example, is talking about, well, now we have this thing capped and everything is going to start getting better. In fact, I have a quote from one scientist. His name is Jeffrey Short, who has said, people are so worried, and now this is not the quote, but he's saying people are so worried that this is not going to go away. And this is the quote. It's not going to last forever. Thoughts that this is going to kill the Gulf of Mexico are just wild overreactions. So we have, you know, so-called scientists telling people, go on, get on with your life. It's sort of the Bush version of, you know, go shopping while we bomb Iraq. It's kind of amazing to watch people just do that.
It really is. And I think that's a really good analogy, Susan. I hadn't quite thought of it that way, but I think that's really what we're looking at here. We have an Obama administration completely in bed with the oil industry. You know, Obama's basically parroting BP lines now. Anytime BP says something like, right now, as they're saying, well, looks like the cap is holding, we're going to give it another 24 hours. We may well be able to leave it on indefinitely until the relief wells are able to get down there and get the job done, even though there's no guarantee with any of this. And a lot of insiders within the oil industry are being very critical of this and saying, look, the fact that the pressure is still holding below 7,000 PSI is indication, as BP's own words earlier were, that the well is a failure and that there is a big leak down in there somewhere, and that's most likely what's happening. Yet we see Obama basically parroting BP, reassuring people, look, it's okay. I'm hopeful. It's not done yet, but I am hopeful. You know, and this is exactly what BP's saying. So he's being a very good corporate spokesperson here for BP, and I think that's indicative of the federal government policy that we're seeing firsthand. Is that, look, it's okay. Go in the water. Go shopping. It's pretty amazing to watch this.
Well, go back to what you mentioned. Oil people that you're talking to are saying we don't really know what's going on yet. It may still be leaking. Say more about that.
Well, there's some of this actually. We had another photo essay posted on Truth Out just before this interview started, and I quote an insider oil industry professional who maintains a blog. He is actually over out of Houston, as are several of the other folks who contribute to his blog, he's basically saying that the name of the blog is The Daily Hurricane, by the way, but he's basically saying that, look, with the pressure now basically level at 6,700 PSI of the oil within the cap, which is the lower end of BP's ambiguity range, he says to him it makes sense that there's some leak down the line, basically as he's saying that if you know, they expected on all the computer modeling for there to be between 8,000 and 9,000 PSI in the cap. And but as long as the oil maintained a pressure of at least 7,500 or more PSI, then that was indicative that the well was intact. If it topped out at below 7,500, then that was indicative that the well was a failure. And the thinking behind this, that is, if it doesn't get up to at least 7,500 PSI, you know, it's like putting your hand over the end of a garden hose, and the pressure, instead of continuing to build up to what it should be, that's going to basically show you where all the leaks are down the line, because water would start spewing out of it. And that's basically what's happening here with this well. And so when you cap it, and then, as BP has even admitted, they're using sonar then to go down the well and the well casing underground to see if they can find any leaks down in there. And they're not being forthcoming about what they're finding, but a lot of the insiders are saying, look, this is indicative that there are leaks down in damaged casing further down underground, so there is oil coming out. When you cap it, that's going to force the oil to come out somewhere down within the rock, and that's what a lot of people think is happening now, which is actually a very worrisome situation, because if you keep that cap on, those leaks will worsen over time, because there's so much pressure that literally it will just keep seeping out of the rocks and then just come up in different places. And that's what a lot of people are concerned about right now.
And so the message that's going out is, oh, this cap is working well, look at the pressure. And most of us don't really understand the first thing about that kind of discussion, the technical side of it. And meanwhile, behind the scenes, the work will continue at a lower level or something, but most people will not understand that this is an ongoing emergency.
That's right, and I think that's what's really, really critical, that people need to understand that this thing is far from over, and as much as all of us want this to be over and want to hear that, yes, this thing is over and there's no more oil that's going to come out of this because it's been so catastrophic, as much as we all want to believe that, we have to be real and sober in our assessment of what we're looking at here and what it means, that this thing is very, very far from over. Even if they did cap it right now and not another drop of oil ever came out of this thing into the Gulf of Mexico, we're still looking at, going with higher end estimates, 34 Exxon Valdez is worth of oil floating around in the Gulf of Mexico. And what we've seen on the surface and what we've seen hit shore so far is just the tip of the iceberg. This is what most of the scientists are saying when they look at this, and most of the environmental groups that we've been talking with, that is their concern. They're well aware of the fact that BP's used dispersant at the source. They've used more than 1.8 million gallons of this dispersant so far. They're still using it every single day, either above the surface or undersea, and that's causing these giant subsea plumes to be floating around. Some of them are 10 and 20 miles long and several miles wide and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of feet thick. So we literally are still talking about these giant oil icebergs where, you know, you maybe see a little tip of it on top, but the vast majority of the volume of the oil is still floating around undersea, wiping out massive amounts of wildlife. One of the more shocking things, we've seen recently was, I think I talked to you about it before, was being down in Barataria and literally seeing video of crabs. This was video taken by a charter fisherman down there, of crabs literally crawling out of the water into the air at night and staying out until they die because the water is so toxic. That's how much dispersant and how much toxicity is now in different parts of the water down here. And so it's incredible, and this is a very, very huge situation, and it's not going to go away for years when you talk to people. And the captain, Captain Luis Scrimeta of the boat that took us out to the ship, to Ship Island yesterday, he's a multi-generational skipper who's been doing this, and he's point blank. He said, look, we're destroyed. I mean, we're looking at a situation now where our whole livelihood is based on the water here. And, we were on a boat, there were 128 people on his ship, his ferry boat, taking people out. He said, usually this time of the summer, this ship is maxed out. We have 500 people. We have another ship. There's 500 people on that. And we're doing laps, taking people out to these islands. And right now, there were 80 something people on the earlier ship, and there were 120 something people on the boat we were on. And that's how this is affecting people here, and that's not going to change. And that's another reason why locals that live down here and make their living on the Gulf of Mexico one way or another are very concerned right now. And, you know, when you ask them about the future, most of them just get very quiet.
Dara, I want to talk more about that trip, but I want to say I did a little research and discovered a very interesting article about a 1969 barge spill that happened off Buzzards Bay in Massachusetts. It was 189,000 gallons of fuel oil spilled into the bay, and some scientists have remained working on that spill in that zone. And one of them says that the crabs there, talking about the crab video that you had just this week, said that the crabs, quote, still act drunk. Now, this was way back from 1969, and still today, these crabs act drunk. They move erratically and react slowly to predators. That is, they suffer a kind of narcosis induced by hydrocarbon poisoning. That's 1969.
Right. And I'm hearing the same thing. The same fellow who showed me the video of the crabs and then took me down there a couple of days later and showed us the carcasses of the crabs also said that when he was filming the crabs that night that there were shrimp, and he described them just that way. He said it almost like they were drunk, that they were up right on the surface, just swimming right up near the surface, and a lot of them were swimming in circles. He said, again, I've never seen them act like this. He's a commercial fisherman. He's been doing this for 50-plus years, and he was just shocked, and you could tell he was very taken aback and scared by what he saw. That, you know, clearly wildlife is very damaged, both from chemical toxicity as well as, and I've seen many other reports about this, where there's so much methane and so many other gases released into the water column, coupled with the dispersants, all of which sucking out oxygen, and that is basically starving the wildlife. And so we've had reports across the Gulf of pods of dolphins, schools of fish, crab, shrimp, everything running from this stuff. Mm-hmm. In one of our earlier pieces, I quoted an EPA, one of the EPA's own studies that showed of the Corexit dispersants that immediately when they tested this on shrimp, immediately 50% of the shrimp died upon having initial contact with the Corexit dispersants, and then over time, most of the rest of the shrimp died too. And that's exactly what we're seeing here in the Gulf.
Hmm. Let's talk a little about human health. Are you seeing any more evidence of people really suffering and struggling with those same chemicals in the air?
Definitely. You know, anyone down in the areas where a lot of this stuff, mostly over in Louisiana so far, because of the way the wind patterns and the current patterns, that continues to be the area most heavily hit, and also because of proximity. I mean, by far and away the closest area to the source out in the Gulf. But mostly in southeast Louisiana, for several reasons, for all of the chemical reasons we just discussed of the dispersants and the oil coming up onto land, but then also because they've done more than 300 controlled oil burns out at sea. When they skim up, when it's calm enough, they can skim up big goops of the crude oil that comes up to the surface and then do a flash burn of it. And, of course, that sends massive amounts of toxic smoke up into the air. And so there's actually been a lot of people along the coast of Louisiana that have been made sick, have upper respiratory problems, nasal problems, eye problems because of you can imagine the smoke this puts out. I mean, this is very, very similar in toxicity to when someone burns a tire. That black, sooty, ruddy smoke that goes up into the air, well, it's the same thing happening here, except on a massive scale. And so we are having continued reports of people being made sick and having problems with that. And I've even heard a couple of, some of our friends that were putting in touch with folks over in Louisiana, some of them in environmental groups, literally knew of a couple of people that, as they said, were on their deathbeds because of extreme chemical exposure.
Hmm. And what's the air like in Alabama where you are now?
Well, here it's not bad. There's definitely a lot of evidence of oil. There are tar balls. Some of these beaches have been hit pretty hard, but that was a couple of weeks ago. And given that this entire community, the livelihood of these folks is based on the tourist industry, cleanup crews have done a pretty good job of getting most of the tar balls off the beaches. Like I said, there's still booms all down the coast, evidence of this thing all over the place. But right now, the air quality, at least from what we see initially, having just basically gotten in late last night and gotten up today to start to look around, it seems okay, and a lot of that is the direction of the wind. Right now it's coming basically out of the south-southwest, and what gets really worrisome is when it starts coming from the southeast, which is the direction of the source, then that's when we're going to start getting hit with more of the toxified air, and a lot more of the oil already out in the water column will start heading up on the shores again. And that's the thing that I think people need to understand is all this stuff is out there floating around in the water or underneath the water. And whenever the wind pattern changes and stays from that direction for a certain amount of time, and what really worries people is when the first big hurricane comes through that area and pushes all that stuff up onto the land, that's when we're going to really see this at levels that we haven't seen before.
Dar, I know you've just arrived in Alabama, but are you getting a sense of how the media is being treated there? Any indication that it's similar to what you've experienced in Louisiana?
It's relaxed a bit because, again, this isn't an area that's been hit nearly as hard as Louisiana. And, of course, after the uproar that came immediately in the wake of the policy that journalists couldn't get within 60 feet of booming or recovery operations, or they would be fined $40,000 and given a Class D federal felony. They relaxed that to where now it's 20 feet, and if you're a credentialed journalist, then you're going to be okay. So they have relaxed it a bit. We haven't had any more confrontation with people. There's been, you know, we've gotten some nasty looks when Erica was taking pictures on Ship Island yesterday nearby a cleanup crew. You know, these cleanup crews basically have people acting as foremen, and, you know, they'll still give you some nasty looks and that kind of thing. But there hasn't been really anything beyond that. Right now, at least as far as the media control, they seem to have backed off a bit, particularly after the, you know, the hell that was raised in the wake of their initial draconian measures. Mm.
Dar, some of the photographs that have been coming out that you and Erica have been taking are really amazing. I want you to tell listeners where they can go and see that. And then let's also talk about the visit to the site that that you visited last week.
Right. Well, right now we're posting all of our reports on my website, which is dar.org, D-A-H-R.org. Most of them have been run on truthout.org as well, so they could find them at either one of those places. It was actually early last week, we flew out to the source, which I keep referencing. This is what now everyone, particularly the oil industry, refers to as the area out there where the Deepwater Horizon rig blew up and sank on, blew up on April 20th and then sank 3 days later. And so now the Macondo well, which they started down there at 5,000 feet below the surface of the Gulf of Mexico and where all the oil is coming out, that is now referred to as the source. And so we went with a seaplane company out of New Orleans and flew down there, and this was a seaplane company that actually has special clearance to go down and fly, because out at the source, the FAA regs are that you can't fly below 3,000 feet, but this seaplane company has managed to get clearance to fly at 1,500 feet. So Erica, myself, and an individual from one of the environmental groups, Gulf Coast environmental groups with really good clearance, got in this little Cessna seaplane and flew out, and it's about an hour and 15 minutes out from New Orleans down to the source, and basically just did clockwise circles around this area until we had all the photos and video we needed, and basically our eyes and lungs couldn't take it anymore, because flying out there and seeing this was shocking. I mean, all of us were traumatized by it, because it's kind of, you know, most of us have seen photos in history books of Pearl Harbor. It's like that. It's kind of like a war zone or a war scene where you fly out there and there is just massive industry floating atop the Gulf of Mexico. There's the two drill rigs drilling the relief wells. There's the what's called the Transocean Discoverer Inspiration, which is the new ship they brought out there to put the cap on. So they look like giant floating oil rigs. There's several oil tankers out there. Whenever they do siphon up oil, they put it on some of these oil tankers to literally then process the oil and make money on what they do save and can bring up to the surface. All of these are surrounded by numerous other vessels. I'm not in the industry, so I don't know what they're doing, but other big boats with helipads on them and support ships, I suppose. And then on one of the rigs, where a lot of the oil is being brought up, and where they bring up benzene and methane, they literally have to burn that off. And so there's one rig with a big, giant flame shooting off the edge of it where they're literally burning off these gases that are coming up with the oil in very large amounts. And so, and then, of course, all of this is all the entire water there and in every direction as far as you can see out there. It's solid oil and very, very heavy sheen atop the Gulf of Mexico, and it burns your eyes. You can smell it. It gets in your nose. It gets in your lungs. It makes you a bit dizzy and kind of lightheaded and spacey. So we flew around it for probably, I think it was about 30 or 40 minutes. Erica took hundreds and hundreds of photos. I was taking video most of the time, and then after about 30 or 40 minutes, I mean, we just had to go. We basically couldn't take anymore. It's a shocking sight.
Hmm. I want to tell our listeners also that they can get involved in the work that you're doing by making a donation and keeping you down there as long as possible, and they can do that through DAR.org, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so listeners, let's keep Dar down there. He's in Louisiana right now. Let's keep him down there as long as we can and keep this kind of media going, and that contribute at dahr.org. Dar, so how much longer do you expect to be in the region?
Well, we're here for at least one more week, probably a little bit longer, and we're then going to look at either going back home and then planning a return trip, or possibly staying a little bit longer this time. We're kind of winging it depending on funding as well as kind of how things keep developing here, because another thing we're going to want to do is if, assuming the worst-case scenario happens and a giant hurricane does come ashore somewhere in this general area where there is so much oil out in the water column, we're going to want to be here right in the aftermath for that, too.
Is there any, does the weather look as though it's heading in that direction at this point?
Right now, I mean, we watch it several times a day, as I think most people in this area, because that is worst-case scenario. And so right now, there's a slight disturbance down in the South Caribbean, but nothing that looks threatening, nothing big out in the Atlantic. So right now, it looks fairly clear, which is a good thing.
And then let's end with, I think, my questions are head in a certain direction, but I want to give you some open time just to talk about whatever it is that you think people should really know that we're not touching on yet.
Well, really, I think what we touched on earlier, just that this is a ongoing story that's going to be a huge crisis down here for years to come. Already, much of the fishing industry for this entire season has been completely shut down. Tourism is already taking a hit. This is going to have impact on state and federal policy and the damage to the marine and wildlife and ecosystems of the Gulf of Mexico has been absolutely catastrophic. And so don't pay attention to the rhetoric in the mainstream media that's kind of portraying this as though it's about to be wrapped up, because one way or another, whether they really do successfully stop oil from coming out of this thing again or not, and I think it's going to be the latter, unfortunately, given time, this thing is going to be with us for years and years, and it's going to affect all of us.
And again, listeners can go to dar.org or truthout.org to see, to read your writing and also to see some of these amazing pictures that are coming out of there. And also dar.org to donate and keep you down there for as long as possible. So,
thanks very much, Susan. That would certainly be helpful, and I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk again before we take off.
I hope so. So let's plan on another update next week.
Sounds great.
Thanks, and best of luck. Keep doing what you're doing, and folks, help out dahr.org. I'll have a link from our website, RaisingSandRadio.org, to the Truth Out article mentioned in this interview, where you'll be able to find Erica Blumenfeld's extraordinary photographs. That is the theme music to Ariel Luckey's performance piece, Freeland. Before we begin our in-depth interview with Ariel Luckey, I want to remind you that this is Raising Sand Radio, a weekly hour-long show, and I'm the host, Susan Gallimore. All our shows are archived on our website, RaisingSandRadio.org. We're a project of Motherspeak, and we're fiscally sponsored by the Peace Development Fund. Go to the website, RaisingSandRadio.org or Motherspeak.org. to make a contribution to our show, or also to find the range of progressive topics that we do, and you can download any of those shows for free. Coming up is the trailer to an updated version of Ariel Luckey's Free Land. After that, we will spend the rest of the hour with Ariel Luckey.
Cowboys and Indians, settlers and treaties, blah, 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 blah. Like I'll ever remember in 10 years, the Homestead Act of 1862. I'm just a white boy,
Attracted to the color, disconnected from my roots. So I reach for another's. I'm discovering power and beauty in Lakota culture. Like the sacred eagle, but I feel like a vulture. Dancing on the graves and singing the songs. I just want a community where I belong.
Grandfather, why did our family come out west? This is not where we came from. How did we get that land that the ranch was on? He says his father, my great-grandfather, brought the family out from Missouri and settled the ranch as a homestead, a free land grant from the government. 270 million acres of stolen Native American land, 10% of the country, given to white people for free. First, the army invaded with firearms and fire water, burning death across the plains. Within 10 miles of my family's ranch is a National Historic Site. The Dull Knife Battlefield. Come with me to the bitter end of life at the clandestine campgrounds of Chief Dull Knife. Nestled in a valley of sage and evergreen trees, herds of horses, fire pits, and teepees. Families sleep and the sun begins to rise as the morning quiet is murdered in deafening surprise. Storming, thunder of hooves and battle cries. War songs echo as the first bullet flies. You a soldier riding out of hiding, guns blasting. Attacking the Cheyenne village in fast action. The troops hunt men, women, and children. The valley stinks with the stench of killing, 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 killing. Red costs the free land. Can you imagine the cost of free land? I now know the history of the ranch and that land in Wyoming. But what went down here in Oakland? Who lived on this land? What happened to them? Digging down. Who? Ah! 1999. Down beneath sidewalk and street. Mall construction disturbs buried bodies. A lonely ancestor sleep for thousands of years. Wake up to the sound of blaring bulldozers scraping their souls into steel boxes. Some bones so toxic they feel like rubber. So drunk off chemical cocktails, they're handled and disposed of as toxic waste. Others buried in unmarked mass graves, hundreds removed from their resting place to create space for the foundation of the new mall. Say nothing about Ohlone burials, nothing about the thousands of bodies already removed, nor the hundreds that remain, nothing about the vibrant Ohlone community alive today. After all the bloodshed, generations of war, after all the broken treaties of lies and brute force, after 500 years of colonization, the broken backs and heart attacks that built this nation, we stand on stolen land, with the past in our hearts and the future in our hands. Are we prepared for the changes of character, breaking the barriers in Native America? How can we carry the legacy and move forward as builders, teachers, artists, healers, warriors?
It's my great pleasure to welcome Ariel Luckey to our show today. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's really a pleasure to sit down and talk with you because I came across your performance piece on YouTube called Shell Mound, and I was so struck with it, and I was very pleased to learn that you're in the Bay Area so that we can sit down together. And Shell Mound, we just heard a clip from it, and I wanted to talk with you, Ariel, about that piece, how it came about, and how it's been received, and let's talk about how it came about.
Absolutely. So the Shell Mound story is actually an excerpt of a larger piece called Freeland, which is a full evening length one-man show. It's 90 minutes long. And the Shell Mound story comes towards the end. So let me back up a little bit and give you a context for where the Shell Mound fits into this larger story. Freeland is my one-man show. It's an autobiographical piece. And it starts with my childhood, you know, growing up in the Bay Area and learning, you know, like every kid in this country does about cowboys and Indians and
Native Americans, and, you know, stuff happened to them a long time ago in history, and it was all very sad, but that's, you know, kind of distant and somewhat irrelevant. And then it follows my journey as I grow up and learn more. And as a young man, I decided to interview my grandfather. I wanted to learn more about my family history and my roots. And so I was interviewing him, and he grew up on a ranch in Wyoming in the 1920s. And, you know, during that era, there was no water, running water, didn't have electricity. This was like the wild, wild west, right? This was the west back then. So I was asking him more about his childhood, trying to get a sense of my family history. And I asked him how we got that land that the ranch was on. He said it was a homestead, a free land grant from the government. Now, that was the first time I had ever heard that term before in my family. We had always referred to it as the ranch. And so when I heard it was a homestead, that kind of shifted something and kind of struck something in me. And I started, you know, asking more questions. Okay, is free land okay? The government gave it to our family. Well, who lived on that land before our family? And I asked my grandfather, and he said it was empty. Now, I knew enough to know, of course, that land was not empty. There were Native Americans who were living there before, but, you know, I had no idea who in particular and what had happened to them. So I started doing research, and I found out that that on that very same piece of land, in 1876, there was a major battle between the Northern Cheyenne and the U.S. Army. The Army attacked the Cheyenne as they were sleeping at dawn, killed a bunch of people, sent a lot of them off into the winter without any supplies. It was just this, you know, horrific thing that happened. And once I found that out, you know, the connection was really clear that, you know, if that battle hadn't happened and the Cheyenne hadn't been kicked off their land, my family wouldn't have gotten that ranch and, you know, my life would have been really different. And, you know, that, you know, that set off a whole journey, and I ended up doing a bunch of more research and actually going to Wyoming with my grandfather and mother, having a whole experience there, meeting the people, finding the ranch, finding the battlefield, all of this stuff.
Did your grandfather know any of that history?
No, he hadn't known. He hadn't known it at all. And wasn't particularly interested either. Mm-hmm. So I did this whole journey, and all of this is in the show, Freeland, before the Shellmount story. And when I come back to Oakland, having learned, you know, this whole history of that land in Wyoming and met the people and thought about it and gone through this whole process, I realized that I didn't really know anything about the history of this land. Even though I was born in Oakland, I've lived here all my life, that, you know, this is also stolen Native American land, but I didn't really know anything about who had lived here, what had happened to them, what the story of this land was, even though, you know, I've gone to 16 years of formal education, lived here all my life. That information was never, you know, given to me. So again, the questions started coming, and I, you know, felt really compelled in doing the research, and that led to the Shellmount story as it is now, kind of documenting my journey into the history of this land and then grappling with what I find.
And tell me about the process of grappling.
Well, it's hard, you know. It's really painful to learn what happened here, what has happened here. It's not a pretty history. There's a lot of really ugly realities. The violence of the mission system, the legalized slavery in this state during that time, the corporal punishment, you know, the Ohlone were whipped and beaten. They were not allowed to practice their spiritual faith. They were not allowed to speak their language. Families were ripped apart. It was, you know, a really horrific time. And that was really just the beginning. You know, then came the gold rush era and, you know, everything after that. So looking back and learning all of that history, you know, I had to figure out what I was going to do with it. How did I feel about it? How did it relate to me? How did it create the world that I live in now? And I, you know, most of us kind of walk around and take for granted. The connections were there and were really clear. So, you know, I included part of the Shellman story. There's a song called The Red Poem where I'm really reflecting on those questions and, you know, okay, well, I'm still a white man with white skin privilege living on this land, you know, benefiting from being able to be here. How am I implicated in this story? What does that mean for me? And then, you know, what does that mean for my relationship with the Ohlone today? You know, there's Ohlone folks who are here right now, living in Oakland, living in the Bay Area. What does that mean in terms of my responsibility or my relationship with the Native American community and supporting them around the political struggles that they face now?
And I want to talk about that part of it also. When you were going through this, the grappling part of, you know, who you are and how you got here, did you have a support system? Who were you talking with about that, and how were they receiving the information?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I shared a lot of it with friends. I mean, I have a community of artists and activists who I work with and connect to. You know, both my family, both my parents have been really supportive, and my wife. And throughout the process, I was also sharing pieces with some of the Ohlone folks that I know in the community, bouncing the information off them and asking them for guidance around accuracy and clarity. And so it was the development of the show was very much a group process and a collective, you know, collectively informed process. My director and I did a lot of public performances, works in progress, you know, where we would have dialogue sessions afterwards to get feedback from the audience as we were developing the play. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think one of the points of the show for me is that, you know, we have to look at this history. We can't pretend that it didn't happen. We can't, you know, close our eyes and it'll just disappear. And it is really painful, but we can do it together. Mm-hmm. And trying to look at it, you know, or deal with it on your own doesn't work.
You must have also got a lot of people telling you that, well, that was the past, that's history, this is the way life is, and this is what you got now. Variations on that.
Sure. Yeah, you know, it's interesting because especially here in California in the West, it's so recent. You know, we're talking of, you know, the Gold Rush was 150 years ago, 160 years ago. In the span of human civilization, if you think about China, you think about Iraq, if you think about, you know, these cultures and civilizations that were around for thousands of years, Europeans have only been here for, you know, the Spanish came a couple hundred years ago, but all of my, you know, white people only came here about 160 or so years ago. So in the span of time, that's just the blink of the eye. And it actually really is very present and recent. And you see, you can look around and you see, you know, you have the impact of the Spanish and the culture. I mean, obviously, everyone, lots of people speak Spanish. You have the mission in San Francisco, the mission in San Jose. There's a lot of the imprint of that history in our landscape today. And so it's not hard to make the connections of how this is still really very much living with us.
And Ariel, Shell Mound actually, I believe, refers to the Shell Mound in Emeryville.
The Ohlone created Shell Mounds all over the Bay Area. The one in Emeryville was the largest in the whole Bay Area. It was over 65 feet tall and 350 feet wide. It was bigger than a city block. Ships could navigate around the bay by locating the shell mound. It was a very large phenomenon. But there were shell mounds all around the bay, and there still are. The one in Emeryville has been almost completely destroyed. It was leveled in 1924, and now is the site of the Bay Street Mall. And it was, you know, but it was, before it was destroyed, it was in an archaeological site of global significance. You know, it had been created over 4,000 years. It had thousands of human remains and, you know, artifacts, jewelry, pottery, arrowheads, etc. Was there, most of which was destroyed wholesale by the folks who leveled the shell mound.
What's interesting particularly to me is this idea of trying to come to grips with it in a larger, you know, it being how we got here mm-hmm. and what we did to get here, we being the white sort of hegemonic people that are here right now. There's a lot of resistance to actually facing that, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is that it doesn't reflect well on, you know, like my ancestors and, you know, quote unquote white people. You know, you notice this in, you know, when people are telling their family history or even speaking of someone who's passed away, there's a general tendency to only say the nice things about a person or about, you know, the family or whatever. And I think, you know, that's a natural kind of human thing. You want to look good and, you know, it reflects on ourselves. But for me, part of it is, you know, a real clear commitment and value to the truth, you know, and really being clear about what is true, not just what looks good. And, you know, the other part of that is that I think it does, there is an inherent implication for action for now. You know, acknowledging the injustices of the past clearly makes us in some ways complicit with injustice that's happening now. And unless we're kind of prepared to do something about that and be involved in, you know, a million different ways, you know, it doesn't lend itself to passivity. So if someone just wants to be passive and live in a, you know, bubble and a privileged life, then bringing up these topics can be really uncomfortable because of the implication for action today.
But also, if you don't necessarily want to just be passive, but you want to very actively work against looking at that truth, and I think that there is a tendency in this United States to feel like, you know, this is manifest destiny, we deserve this because we fought for it. And so, in other words, a very active fight to maintain the cover.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you see that right now in Texas as they're rewriting some of the history textbooks, eliminating key figures of color from history like Cesar Chavez, or in Arizona where they just recently outlawed ethnic studies. You know, I think if someone's purpose is white supremacist, you know, to be blunt about it, and in that they are trying to glorify the historical exploits of white people, minimize the contributions of people of color and the, you know, genocide against people of color that has happened in this country, then that is what it is. You know, it's not honest. Like I said, I mean, I think it's part of it is about coming back to reflecting the realities of what really has happened. And it's certainly not democratic or multicultural. It's not reflective of the society and including all of the members of our society that we live in today. But absolutely, there are definitely strong elements of folks doing that in our society right now, trying to rewrite the history. So, you know, I think what I'm trying to do with my work is, particularly from a white perspective, reflect on that as honestly and clearly as I can. And, you know, hopefully engage people in dialogue who are open to really looking at what it means. Because I think that there is a cost to it. One of the questions in my show that I raise is, what is the cost of free land? And what I mean by that is, you know, how does being the descendants of the perpetrators of genocide impact us? You know, spiritually, emotionally, psychologically, how are we living with that? You know, people talk about the post-traumatic slave disorder, right? We know they've done studies that show that for the descendants of slaves or the descendants of genocide, there are psychological costs. There are, you know, this emotional legacy that people live with. What does that mean for folks on the other side? You know, for the, you know, the soldiers who slaughtered men, women and children at Wounded Knee, at the massacre of Wounded Knee. What does it mean to be the descendants of those people? You know, I think there is an inherent benefit to doing this work and looking at the past and, you know, ultimately move towards some sort of healing. You know, there's been examples of, you know, the United States government made a formal apology and had the reparations for the Japanese internment camps. And some people, you know, see that as just a token and symbolic, you know, not very grounded, you know, step. but it is a formal acknowledgement. You know, it's not everything. It's maybe not as much as needed. But in a lot of ways, we as a society have never really come to terms with the genocide against Native peoples in this country. And, you know, you see that in the racism today, the mascots for the sports teams, the Native mascots that are still prevalent, the, you know, use of Native American imagery all around the country. There's a lot of ways that that those patterns are continuing now.
It also allows, when we go to war, for example, with Iraq and now Afghanistan, or Afghanistan and then Iraq, it also allows us to maintain or continue the sense of name-calling, right? Othering people, the ragheads and so forth. And that discussion never sort of comes about either, you know, what's okay for troops when they're out there being sent off to foreign lands. That whole thing is wrapped up, isn't it, in this same conversation?
Absolutely. It's very much the same process of colonization. And in fact, there were soldiers in Iraq who were using some of the language of the West, you know, calling it the frontier, talking about cowboys and Indians. Of course, them being the cowboys, the Iraqi soldiers, and I mean the U.S. soldiers and the Iraqi people being the Indians. So, yeah, it's very much a part of, I think, the psyche of our country. And when they start working up the nationalism and the propaganda and the patriotism to support their, you know, extravagant and horrific war efforts, I think it is very much in the model that, you know, really this country has been founded on. You know, we've been in almost continuous warfare since the beginning of the United States, domestically and abroad. And it's a, you know, very key part of our economy to, you know, people talk about the military industrial complex. So absolutely, I think there are lots of connections to be drawn. It's, you know, again, it's one of those things of like, well, what are we going to do now? You know, okay, we can't go back to 1876 and undo that battle, right? That's in the past. We know it happened. But what can we learn about that? And how can that inform our public policy today, both domestically and internationally?
You're listening to Raising Sand Radio, and I'm Susan Gallimore talking with Ariel Lucky. Since, like most of us, Ariel alluded to not learning much about real history in schools, I asked Ariel if he was promoting his ideas in any of the schools today.
We actually just released a DVD of the full show, Freeland, that includes the Shellmound story in it. And I'm working right now on a study guide that will release this fall that will go along with the DVD so that teachers around the country can show the movie, show the film in their classrooms, and then do follow-up work with their students. And looking at the Shellmound story in particular, one of the things that I think is really powerful for students is for them to learn the history of the land that they live on, which is the process that I went through in creating and developing the Shellmound story. It really can change the way you see the world. I mean, literally, when I walk down to Emeryville or through parts of Oakland and Berkeley, I understand those places and my role in those places differently because I know the history of that land and how all of it has come to be. So what we're doing with the study guide is using the model of the Shellmound story, which is, you know, taking a single place and digging down. And as we dig down, we're moving back in time. So, you know, we go through the major eras of historical significance of a particular place of location. And using that as a model to help teachers teach local history for their students. You know, unfortunately, there is a version of this story everywhere in the country. I've traveled nationally and performed this piece and met with students and teachers and done a lot of work in schools. And everywhere I go, there is a local story of the colonization, of the genocide. You know, who the Native Americans were, and when the Europeans came, and then what conflicts and struggles and massacres and battles and, you know, what happened, how the Native folks resisted, how the Europeans dominated, you know, just what the dynamics were. And there's lots of variation. I don't mean to simplify it in any way, but it is a common national history that unfortunately we share so that students can learn that history anywhere in the country. They can, you know, they can watch the Shell Mound story and learn the history of here, of Oakland, the Bay Area, and then apply that same lens to their own land, their own homeland, and learn that history. You know, I think it's important, and like you said, sadly missing from a lot of current education, I think it's important for students to know the names and some of the culture of the Native folks who have traditionally lived on their land. A lot of times those Native folks are still there. They're often invisibilized or marginalized in some way. A lot of times they're still there. Sometimes they're not. If our attempts to educate students is to make them responsible citizens and inform people in the world, I think it's important for them to know something about the Native American history of this country, of the land that they live on, as well as what happened when the Europeans came. So, and in my experience working with students, young people really get excited about local history. It's tangible, it's local, it's relevant, it's present, and it's not as abstract as, you know, somewhere far away like China or Europe or wherever. You know, this is about stuff that happened in their very backyard and relates to where they live. That's actually a spark for students to get excited. A lot of times they find history really boring. Mm-hmm. And part of what I'm trying to do with the Freeland Project is really invigorate and vitalize history studies so that it's relevant, it's interesting, it's artistic, and it's political, so that students think critically about the issues that are in their lives today.
And how can teachers get in touch with you if they want to know more about that?
The best way is to just go to my website, which is www.ariellucky.com, ariellucky.com. You can also go to the freelandproject.com, www.freelandproject.com. If you're interested in the study guide, sign up on my email list and I'll send you an update when it comes out. There's also lots of information, samples of Freeland and the Shell Mound, photos, biographies, all kinds of information on the website.
One of the things that I've been struck with is there's a Native American chief here. He's called, it's the Rumson Ohlone Chief Tony Cerda. And I saw him, I was at some ceremonies that they were doing in Hunter's Point, and one of the things he said about his dancers at the end of the dance performance for an audience was, well, next time somebody tells you that the Ohlone people have all disappeared, you tell them you saw them dancing here today. And I always get so touched by that, mm-hmm. because there's Ohlone all over the place.
That's
and
right.
The history of the Ohlone has made it such that they've felt like they needed to hide out and submerge their cultural background.
Well, and a lot of times also they've been either ignored or invisibilized or, you know, pushed out from the history textbooks. You know, students are required in the state of California in the fourth grade to learn California history. And if schools were bringing Ohlone speakers in or, you know, involving, and there are some amazing history teachers out there who are doing that, don't get me wrong, but in general, as a culture, as a society, you know, most of us pretend that they don't exist, that they're not here anymore. And so it is really powerful just to acknowledge that. I have a friend who's lived here in Oakland, and she can trace her family back for generations and generations to pre-Spanish times. All of people who have lived here in on this land right here in Oakland. Mm-hmm. And that's a powerful thing. I think it's amazing, and it's important for everybody to acknowledge that. Mm-hmm. Recognize, you know, that most of the rest of us are pretty recent immigrants.
Thank you for being with us today. So that's Ariel Lucky, ariellucky.com.
That's right.
Or thefreelandproject.com.
It's www.freelandproject.com.
Freelandproject.com. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Save the date for Ariel Lucky's show Freeland. There will be one performance only in Berkeley, California on Friday, October 8th, 2010. If you can't be there, there is a DVD that you can purchase, and it's called Freeland, and it's available at www.ariellucky.com, ariellucky.com. Thanks for listening to Raising Sand Radio this week, and I hope you tune in again next week.